Okay. I was just asking about how the rest of the state colleges of education or normal schools reacted to this Wisconsin Improvement Program. Mm-hmm. You were saying?
Well, I think the reaction was quite positive prior to that time. I can recall that meetings of the Association for Student Teaching, which is now the Association for Teacher Education, would bring on frequent chiding sessions on the part of the state teachers' colleges, the state colleges, for the university going into teacher education at all, and then that when they did, that, for instance, the student teaching program was not as effective as theirs because we put too many student teachers in the same room. Now, it's true that it may have been 10 or a dozen art student teachers in one classroom at Wisconsin High. And that's one of the reasons why Wisconsin High School was no longer suitable. We knew it here sooner than they did out in the state colleges, that the enrollment in the teacher education was coming up so much faster than our facilities could absorb. So there was that feeling. Now, I think, though, that with WIP, that we have to recognize that John Guy had fairly close relationships with many of the deans of education in these other institutions. As a matter of fact, some of them, deans and presidents, had been students of his and gotten their PhDs here. Mm-hmm. Now, he didn't use that to blackmail, but it was an easy contact for them and for him. And as I recall the sessions that I attended with WIP and the conferences, that was a very wholesome attitude on the part of those schools. I would say that the most vicious of the experience we had was when we got to talking about opening up a program in elementary education. Mm-hmm. And then all the state colleges that were trying to take their basic program away from them. So there was resentment over that.
Now this was going on back in the 40s.
Oh yes, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if anything that WIP gave some reassurance to the people who had been bawling along there during the 40s and 50s that the university after all was providing a vehicle for the consortium and for what they wanted was cooperation and coordination.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the relationship of John Guy to the rest of the state and of the school, you have mentioned that at some points, especially in your earlier years, the relationship of this department to DPI.
Yes.
And the unity there, the involvement. Perhaps if you could talk a little bit more into the more recent years, say since 1950, of the relationship between the Department of Education and then later the School of Education to DPI in terms of working relationships and personnel, that kind of thing.
Mm. Well, I think I'd have to say it was very close and very effective. Now, I gave you an illustration or two in the state curriculum program. Certainly, all of the units of higher education were much involved in that. And true, this campus was in the leadership position because of Gordon McKenzie being loaned as director of that program. So I think that that the university has held the respect of the DPI, and certainly the surplus commodities program was one that gave them much recognition, and we didn't try to steal away from them. Mm-hmm. It was their show.
Right. Would you say that the university in Madison, in terms of education, was holding more influence with DPI than did the different normal schools around the state, like Platteville?
I would suspect so.
Uh-huh.
I would suspect so, and quite a number of reasons. C.J. Anderson became dean, but prior to becoming dean, and while he was first assistant state superintendent, he was invited to teach summer school.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that didn't hurt the relationship any. The DPI had the director or chairmanship of the North Central Association activities. And they practically always invited some one person from this campus to serve on the state committee along with some of the principals out state and so forth. Mm-hmm. And eventually we got to trading it back and forth. And when Harry Merritt died, he had been chairman of the North Central, and it couldn't have been over 3 or 4 days later that I went to my office at Wisconsin High School one morning, and there was piles so full of boxes I could hardly get to my desk. And there were all the DPI North Central files. And I called John Guy and asked him how come they were storing them in my office. He said, well, I guess I forgot to tell you, you just became chairman of North Central yesterday. So, I mean, that was an incident of a close working relationship. And then it went back and forth some more, too. And I think recently that the university has provided the chairman of state chairmanship. But here again, talk about maybe the DPI taking another turn at it. So it's been a fairly close working relationship. The other thing is that we have to recognize that many of the staff members in the DPI have taken advantage of their work here in Madison to continue graduate studies. Mm-hmm. Even state superintendent and the first assistant superintendent now are both PhDs from this department. Mm-hmm. And I suppose another dozen or two dozen that have earned PhDs from some department here in the university or in School of Education. Then if you go to master's degrees, well, you've got, I wouldn't know how to guess how many. Mm-hmm. But that is a pretty good basis for a close working relationship. In the first place, you become friends. Mm-hmm. Secondly, good personal friendships, a good basis for professional cooperation. And I think it's existing yet.
Now, right now, the Graduate School of Education that was formed in Milwaukee in the latter 50s, I believe, began that action. Mm-hmm. You were the first dean of that school, I believe.
Well, I wasn't just the graduate, that was the School of Education.
But the question I'm getting to is that at one point, this campus was the only campus that offered advanced degrees.
I see what you're getting. Yes, that is true.
Now, recently, other campuses have added education administration degrees and that sort of thing. Has that affected this campus's relationship with DPI in any way?
I can't see that it has. Now, if you go back to that merging, you want to remember that in 55 or 6, whenever it was, I was sent over there on leave for a year to serve as acting dean and to organize the School of Education. And at that time, a part of the merger action was that the graduate students over there would be graduates of the University of Wisconsin Graduate School. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I had to box up 400 graduate student records and bring them over here to the graduate school and have each one of them individually admitted to our graduate school. And from then on, it was a fact. I think at that time we over-merged, and I think that's gotten straightened out now. That was entirely too much dependence and control on this campus. It was resented in Milwaukee, and I think that I had a little hand in trying to get some rationale to the relationships there and to free the people in Milwaukee a bit more to influence their own graduate programs. Mm-hmm. Now, you say, with the other programs and administration over the state, I think the DPI has probably as much control over that, because they have to approve a program in order to accept and grant licenses on the basis of those graduates of the other institutions. Mm-hmm. Now, I expect there's been a little politicking in the back fence and all that sort of thing. I have not engaged in it and have direct observation, but I would suspect there's been some pressures from other schools, such as Superior, for instance. They're isolated. People up there are isolated. And they were one of the first to be granted the privilege of the degree in administration. Now, some of the others haven't. And I think Stevens Point was pushing hard in that direction. I'm not sure they have achieved it yet. But I don't think the people on this campus was up at the DPI opposing that. I think there were other state reasons for granting or not granting the recognition of the program.
One thing that I know of that's sort of the popular wisdom is probably quite incorrect, but you often hear from various places, from general public to students to faculty, that a requirement that the university will require, say, for a teaching certificate, that was imposed by DPI. DPI forces to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Or DPI forces teachers, teaching students to take this. Now, what is the role, maybe you can give a specific example in the past, what is the role of the School of Education in aiding or consulting with DPI when DPI is thinking about making a change in their requirements for certification?
Mm-hmm.
That seems to me an extremely important part of DPI's function, and
it is.
Mm-hmm.
I can't recall of any consideration for the change in certification requirements that the DPI has not given the university and every unit ample opportunity to come in and express themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't mean that they say you folks make the decision, but they at least permit all of them to come and present their thoughts on the matter. And I think that there is, I'm not sure about this, but I believe there is an advisory committee to the state superintendent.
Mm-hmm.
And that committee receives these suggestions and for inclusion or exclusion of various elements in the certification requirements.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to remember that even now, the representatives from the Department of Public Instruction will be coming for an on-campus visit and scrutinizing our program. They do that with every unit of the university.
Mm-hmm. For example, a course that is required, it wasn't originally required, but is now required, was health information for teachers. That was mm-hmm. for elementary teachers. Was that something that, or something like that, would that come out of somebody at DPI saying, we think we ought to have that from what we hear about from schools, and then they suggest it to the university, or is it a faculty member go to them and say, is this something?
I don't want to seem facetious or vindictive in my response to that, but if I had to blame somebody for the silly things that are put in there, I'd blame the legislature. It's very probable.
I didn't say it was silly.
It's very probable that, and I would want to check this out, but it's very probable that there is some legislative action that has made that necessary. Now, certainly on cooperatives, as far back as I can remember, Wisconsin, the legislature said the schools shall teach about co-ops.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't say whether you're going to teach about the consumer or the producer co-ops. And those two happen to be incompatible. Now, what's the teacher going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Just like under mainstreaming now, beginning to get some teachers sued by parents of the children who are somewhat short of being normal learners. And yet the teachers were never trained to handle that. And we have the same problem in a good many of these other things, that usually when the state says that you have to have something on government by way of certification, in other words, something in the program, it's because somebody in the legislature decided that is an essential to get into the schools. Well, the way you get into the schools is to control teacher certification.
Mm-hmm.
I wish the legislature wouldn't go quite so specifically. I guess that's why I made the remark a moment ago. But certainly to set the goal is a proper function of the legislature if they'd only limit themselves to setting the goal and not the procedure and mm-hmm. the process.
Relating to this idea of the university's School of Education's influence on the schools and so on and so forth around the area. Perhaps you can talk a bit about particularly the relationship of Education Administration Department to the surrounding school districts. I know that many, many of the administrators in the local area come here to do advanced degree work. First question is, did the establishment of Education Administration Department change the degree of influence or the degree of activity of Education Administration in terms of its influence on local communities?
I guess I would be hard put to come up with an instance in which I could say that that has happened. I think the relationships have remained mostly the same, but I think there's another kind of thing that's gotten into this that may ruffle it up just a little bit. Now you take the other departments and other programs that come along with some ideas that, well, your whole program R&D center activities represent that. Individually guided education, which has brought multiple contacts from this campus to schools and very often involving many administrators and liaison between this department, to CNI and all the rest of them, and the R&D operation itself, yes, has multiplied in the number of contacts. Now, probably in that process of multiplying, there have been some diversities that may have shown up that our department, perhaps at one time, had the major contact with the administrators, superintendents and principals, in field schools, whereas at the present time, maybe the IGE program has many more. Mm-hmm. But I say that only as a difference, but not as something that's bad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, one thing that could easily be noticed, especially, in particular, I was going to ask about the IGE schools, because it's quite apparent, well, of course, IGE, the concept, I believe, was pioneered here.
Yes.
And in a lot of ways, a lot of the surrounding local schools have served through principals and whatnot, have come here for their training, have served as sort of experimental grounds perfection of the program.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's an extremely close tie, I believe. There's an influence of a university program to what's actually going on in the school, more direct probably than anything else I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that was peculiar to IGE, or would you say that Education Administration has always tended to have that intimate a tie with the program of schools?
No, I think IGE has probably increased both for administrators, or the contact of this department with the schools, as well as CNI and the R&D staff itself with the operation of the local school and the establishment of experimental situations. Now, when you ask that, I recall that I still get copies of the doctoral dissertations, proposals, and I read them because I'm interested, what direction is research moving? Well, I see research projects coming on now of doctoral students in this department that are dealing with the kinds of relationships that have always been essential, but are even more so in discovering the ways and relationships by which administrators can support and carry forward the ideas of the IGE program.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that our department is more and more involved in supportive activities of that program. Of course, it is true that a member of our department now is a co-director or was director of the R&D, Dick Rossmiller.
Mm-hmm.
Fruth, highly involved in it. Jim Lippum, highly involved in the whole program. I think maybe Dean Bowles, so that in community relationship type of thing. So I would say that it's not, instead of taking away the prerogatives of this department, it has enlarged the vision of opportunity to engage in studies and cooperative action with the schools. At least I've found it a source of great encouragement.
One question might be asked is relating to IGE. IGE is one method of setting about to try to organize a school. Of course, there are lots of other ways of doing it. Has that had the fact that that you have an R&D center that's well supported and lots of money for this kind of project, has that in any way had a deleterious effect on the research? That is, you know, there's a tendency to, for research to go where money is.
Well,
has that in some ways cut off old areas of research unnecessarily, or that might come back if there wasn't?
I think that the same as I indicated about the large research project that I was engaged in, and I felt guilty because we told the student what they had to research. When my own inner self says we have to give more freedom to the student, let them come in and concentrate their research on the things that is dearest to their professional interest. I guess you can't help but say, yes, R&D, in supplying money to support, has to set up the parameters within which the research has to be done.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's nothing special.
There's nothing new about
that. I mean, science programs in general.
That's right.
Are very much like that. But it's something new, though, perhaps, for the school education.
Well, yes, in the last 15 years or so, it is quite new, but on the other hand, we have to recognize, too, that it has opened the way for many students to come for an advanced degree that perhaps never would have been encouraged or found it possible to. Mm-hmm. And that in itself is very encouraging.
Okay. If you could make a brief contrast of the various deans of the School of Education. You are probably one of the few people who's known all of them, at least to some degree, I mean, better than most other people I've have or will talk to.
Well, it's true that I knew Dean Anderson before he was a dean. He was a visiting summer session professor here. And I think I indicated my experience earlier in talking about coming in as principal of Wisconsin High School that Dean Anderson was a person who would go to great lengths to work out the details in order to clear the way for people to do what they thought they wanted to do. And I think that's pretty important because he was a facilitator as a dean. And I can't recall any instance in which he seemed to try to dominate. And I think we talked about that somewhat on the merging of the Department of Education and Ed Methods, that he set it up as an arrangement when separated that caused certain kinds of problems that needed to be solved. Now, could anybody come up with a solution other than the merging of the departments, and would you folks get together and do some talking about it? I mean, it was not an imposed type of regulation. Now, Fowkes was a little more aggressive, and I would say yes, that he was much more, he was stimulating, but much more of a management type of control in his relationship to the staff and program. Now, Fowkes also was a person who had interests far beyond the campus, whereas Anderson's was almost 100% the interest here on campus. Now, an illustration of Fowkes' interest is not only his editorship of the series with Harper's, what do you call it, Exploration and Education series, almost 100 books. It was a magnificent series. I'd have to say that because I had a book in it, I guess, but he was recognized as a person of excellent judgment by Harper and Row, which diverted quite a bit of his time from the functions of a dean as Anderson saw them. Then this airborne education program took a lot of Falk's time, but as I have indicated a moment ago, that Falk was a person of great vision and terrific vigor, and he was a program promoter, and he was somewhat the same way here on campus, that you get something started, well, he wanted to move. Now, Stiles was a much more variable type of person, and I think that if we had the feeling that under Falk's that there wasn't much use to go to faculty meetings or School of Ed faculty meetings, because either we weren't going to talk about the things we wanted to talk about, or if we did, they were already settled. I mean, there's quite a bit of the undercurrent of that type. Stiles came in as a person who could bring together the members of the faculty of the School of Education. And I recall the delight that all of us had in going to the faculty of the School of Education meetings and have him tell us, whatever you want to bring to this floor, you bring it. Let me have it. I'll put it on the agenda. So that we felt that we were all of a sudden released to talk about the things that we thought ought to be talked about as a total faculty. My feeling is that we had a greater unity among faculty of the School of Education under Stiles than we had experienced prior to that time, even with the gentility of C.J. Anderson. Stiles was a stimulator, but he has a type of stimulation that I wish a lot of other people had. He stimulated very often through commendation, and that's unusual. At that time, and well, it is right now, of administrators taking the time to commend people. And Stiles could use that. As a matter of fact, I, even within the past half a dozen years, urged him to write an article on the art of commendation, because he used it as a tremendous stimulator. Now, in the process, you say, well, maybe his commendations resulted in some court controls, too. Well, it's a nicer type of control if it is. I don't happen to see it that way, but he was really a great dean. Now, Stiles was also a fighter. And when we hit the problem with NCATE on the accreditation, then for 2 years, it seems to me that he diverted most of his time to trying to discipline NCATE and to win the argument over whether or not our School of Education would achieve accreditation under NCATE. It was a national program, almost, national campaign, I mean, that he waged there. Well, now, as a faculty member, and I'm sure I'm not different from many faculty members, we didn't like to be seen countrywide as a school that's fighting its way back over NCATE, even to trying to get NCATE abolished. Stiles tried to do that. It was embarrassing a little bit to have all the schools look at us as though there must be something awfully wrong up there. NCATE wouldn't be doing that to us. Now, that leads to what did Don McCarty do? Well, he calmed things down, and I think that's what we needed more than anything else. The distress over this national controversy over accreditation was not only embarrassment, but it was distressing to be working under those kinds of accusations. Dean McCarty, I think, did a magnificent job of soothing the situation, and eventually of, well, I guess Stiles achieved the conditional accreditation, so we got through the next 10 years. And then when we got to that one, I happened to have been one of the co-directors of the NCATE development of materials here in Arnett, and I did that. We had limitless support from Dean McCarty, and whatever materials we wanted to gain, even to going around to appearing before each department in the School of Education, he went with us. And we were telling him the kinds of things that we were trying to develop and the kind of data we thought we needed to put on display at that time. And he achieved for us in that way, almost 100% cooperation, not only of the department organization, but of the individuals. And the office just across from the dean's, former dean's office up in the education building, was the NCATE office. And we had in there the exhibits of all of the things. For instance, if somebody said, well, professors stay on and get on tenure and then they coast, we had evidence that the tenured professors in their senior years were outproducing all the younger ones. Mm-hmm. And we had it documented. Now, these are the kinds of things that McCarty made it possible for us to get and financed the secretarial and assistant help that required for it. So I would say that McCarty put us back on a very, very even track. But we lost one thing in the process, I have to be frank about that. Our School of Education meetings did not stimulate the enthusiasm for the total organization that it had under Stiles. That slipped, there's no doubt about it. But everybody can't contribute the same thing, and Don McCarty contributed something else that we were needing awfully bad, and I feel very grateful to him for it.
Now, one thing ought to be asked just out of fairness to everybody involved here is that each dean exerts a different certain power over the school education, mm-hmm. That's clear.
Yes.
But where was the structure of the school education or the structure of the dean's office changing during this time as well? Or is it simply a matter of the different people involved?
I would say it's more a matter of the different people, their perceptions of their own work and how they go about it. Structure, I'm not really much aware that changed a great deal. They've added personnel, but so is all organizations for that matter. But here again, the increase in the number of functions, the expectations placed by the state and university administrators has called for much more specific administration. One time we didn't have a business manager. Mm-hmm. We had a secretary who kept the books. Well, you couldn't get by with that now with all of the funds that are being administered, grants and so forth. It simply has become a much more complex organization. And even the placement office was a one-man, one-secretary operation when I first came here. And now it's taken on many more functions, and it's doing a better job. Mm-hmm. So, sure, we've increased the number of people, the number of functions, but I don't think that is necessarily changing the structure.
Okay. As long as we're going along and contrasting people and things, perhaps you could also discuss a rather important subdivision of, an older subdivision of the School of Education, of the handling of the Department of Education by the various people who were the chairs of that department. Now, one thing I should ask is that before the reorganization, is it fair to say that the Department of Education very nearly was a school of education, and that the chairman of that department was a rather important person, say more important than individual department chairman after the reorganization?
Oh, I think that's a fair statement. In the first place, if they wanted to go into the School of Education meeting, they could go in with a predetermined posture and probably outvote everybody else, because the L&S people seldom came. Mm-hmm. So it was just that big Department of Education with 60-some votes against Art Ed and Fire Ed and so what have you, mm-hmm. where they had a much more limited number of faculty. Yes, I think that was true.
If you could then, perhaps you can run through the names we have here and just discuss the mode of operation, mm-hmm. that each constructed.
Well, you have some of the names here. I would say that Matt Welling and Cliff Little were very, very comparable in their mode of operating as chairman of the department. quiet spoken, never ruffled over anything, good sense of humor, and never pushing at anything particularly. They would say, we'll keep the office going, and so long as nobody's coming in ruffling things up, why, that's the way it'll go. Now, that doesn't mean that they weren't effective. They were very effective for the functions that the members of the department wanted from a department chairman at that time. Now, when Russ Hostler came along, not only that Russ Hostler is a much more open, outgoing, dynamic person than Matt or Cliff, and I've known all of them so well that and have very fondness for them. But you want to remember that when Russ came in, I don't remember exactly the dates of that, but I think it was at the point of our
about 1955, I think.
Yeah, but our enrollments were increasing, I think, tremendously then. And it had, I believe, for 6 or 8 years following World War II. And Russ had to take a much more aggressive posture in order to meet the requirements of increased numbers and a great variety of expectations on the part of students. And there was much more, as I recall, much more program development at that period. Now, not that Russ was a cause of that, but he had to operate differently in order to coordinate it as chairman of the department, which perhaps made it seem that he was much more of a dictatorial person. I don't call it that. I think he was a good manager, and certainly was trained in business management, and did bring us along without getting all gummed up on finances, student records, and program requirements, extension, which grew tremendously in those years. So I would say that Russ was a different person, also in a different time. Now, with Leroy Peterson, I think Cliff Hutchins came in there, and then I came in following Russ Hostler for, what was it, 2 years or so with the old Department of Education, and then was still chairman at the time we made the major division of the departments, and then our new department admin asked me to go on for, I guess, another 2 years or something like that as chairman of that department. And so we would we'd have to say that we're in the process of resolving many problems that came about as a result of the reorganization of departments. Now, let me tell you what kinds of things that Leroy Peterson was up against. He had all of the records in that office up there that had been accumulating since the year one. Personnel records, exam records. What are you going to do with them? Even to this day, you have to find out where a record is, and you hope it's in archives, because it might, for a while, it might be over in CNI, because that was the direct inheritor of most of the functions of the old Department of Education, you see. And Ed Admin was one little segment of the program, but not a dominant group within the department. It was still the undergraduate program that was the dominant responsibility of the Department of Education, and the graduate studies growing, to be sure. Well, Leroy had to work his way through all of those. I expect he stepped on some toes in the process, but I didn't hear about any great wrongs that people thought he was doing. He had to make some real tough decisions on disposition of records. And it's just like, what did you do with the academic record of students in Wisconsin High after you closed Wisconsin High?
What happened with this reorganization, with everybody going off in 10,000 directions, what happened to the students? Were things managed to be kept closely, tightly organized enough that the students didn't appreciate what was going on too heavily, or?
Well, I don't know how much they could learn just from the little riffles that could be feeling they were feeling from the faculty, but I would say I doubt if students got hurt very much. In the first place, Wisconsin always has put a lot of responsibility on the major professor, the advisor, Now I'm talking about graduate students here.
Right.
I think they would get the potential for getting hurt the most. The undergraduates would stay right in CNI, and there wouldn't be that major conflict of who's going to make the decisions. But I think that the advisors cushion most of the problems that might befell students and didn't because the faculty took the responsibility of trying to work those. In the transition period, I don't believe any students got hurt.
Okay.
Now, not to my knowledge.
I haven't heard of any such either, but I'm just wondering how that would go. I can sometimes imagine how it might go.
Well, supposing that we had in the old Department of Education a major control of one office over the graduate program, in other words, the course selections, the exam procedures, and so on, then I think we would have had some real problems. But we didn't have that in the old department. We still had the advisor as the dominant controller of the student's program within the ranges legislated, of course, by the graduate school and by the department. But I just can't believe students got hurt in that process.
Yeah. That seems pretty complete. Let's start one more thing. You were on the search committee when Dean McCarty was picked.
Yes.
How did that get set up? How did you come to be on a committee, and what sorts of things did the committee go through in selecting a dean?
The committee was named by Bob Fleming, the chancellor at that time. We lost him, you know, the University of Michigan. Robert Fleming, a great chancellor. And who his advisors were, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, I had just arrived home one evening, telephone rang, and he wanted to know if I could come and talk with him the next day about serving as chairman of the search committee for a new dean of the School of Education. I told him I would, and my first question was, is the job open? I almost offended him with that because I'd had some indication that one other similar circumstance that they had said to the chairman of the search committee, be sure you have this one person on, and that person became dean. I said, I will not accept it unless you leave it wide open, and he assured me that he would.
Yes.
So, yes.
Okay.
Well, as I say, I don't know who his advisors were in inviting me to be chairman of the committee, nor who his advisors were in naming the committee. I had no part in the selection of those committee members.
Mm-hmm.
And they were representative of both LNS and education schools or colleges. And I thought it was a good committee. Now you say, how do we operate? Well, we got a bulletin out to all faculty members in our university through their deans, as I recall. And the details here, I might be a little fuzzy on that. But we invited people to suggest names, and then the committee would make the determination with whatever evidence we had on hand as to whether we would invite people specifically to supply further information and to come in for interviews.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, we had about half a dozen people come in for interviews. There was one tremendous campaign on for a person who was already on campus. And
over which campus?
Person who already was on this campus.
Yeah. Right.
And he was not acceptable to many of the people in the departments of education. And so that brought on a rather energetic action on the part of many staff members to bring in suggestions. I don't remember how many we had, probably 25 or 30 suggestions. We had five or six come in for interviews,
mm-hmm.
and Don McCarthy was one of them. And the committee liked Don, and he became our recommendation to the chancellor.
Now, how did the committee work? That is, when somebody was coming in to interview for dean, or at least in this case, mm-hmm. Of course, they're going to talk to the committee. Are they also asked to speak with the rest of the faculty of the School of Education and that sort of thing? How does that work?
Not necessarily. The only thing that we did was to let the faculty know that if they would like to interview selected persons when they came in, we would make that privilege available to them. Now, yes, the interview was with each of the committee members individually. And then we asked the chancellor and any other dean if they would like to, graduate school particularly, if they would care to get acquainted with this candidate. If they said yes, then we would deliver the candidate to them for that opportunity. Mm-hmm. Then so we'd ask them to give the committee their reaction.
At no point then would a potential dean be asked to address a group or something, or to make
No, I don't recall that that was ever done. It seems to me that Don McCarty had been here in connection with the school board project that Russ Gregg was running. But that was the year or two before we were looking for a new dean. And a good many people here were acquainted with Don personally, because he was on, did some sort of a school board study back in New York. And they brought him out here on a consultation basis for the project here in Wisconsin. And in that way, many of us had gotten acquainted with him personally. But I don't know that made that much difference. It couldn't have with anybody except Ned Edmund, because he had no contacts with anybody else. Mm-hmm. And he was, as I recall, he got the unanimous vote of the committee in the end.
Now, when the trend seems to have been over the years that the dean holds a position for sort of a limited period of time, mm-hmm. when you interviewed a person like McCarty or anybody for that position, was there an understanding that this position would be for a fairly limited number of years at that point, or not?
Absolutely not. The only thing is that we took the responsibility for negotiating with departments for a tenured position. Mm-hmm. And I think that's characteristic of the entire university system operation. They get a new chancellor, they put them into some department, and then when they get to be 62, that department gets them. Mm-hmm. For better or worse.
Because, well, perhaps you can, I don't know if there's anything to it, because the deans have been there for a long time, but it seems that there's a trend to shorten the time there for one reason or another. I don't know if that's a coincidence or...
Well, I can't believe that it's a result of any sort of policy determination. Mm-hmm. It may be just a part of our societal reactions now. You want to remember that school superintendents don't stay as long as
right.
they used to. And school board members, whereas the tenure used to be 20 years on the school board, is down to about 3 or 3.5 now. And it just seems that we've become that more restless about our management and control positions.
Right. Okay.
Same thing going when they want to change the term of president to 6 years now.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't policy right now. But it's what you're saying. It has operated seemingly that way, but I can't find any compulsion to it.
Okay. One thing I'm kind of curious about, when I was asking earlier about if students were allowed into, like graduate students were allowed into faculty meetings back in the 30s, and said no.
No, I would almost say that a student never thought of it as any sort of a possibility or even desirability.
Uh-huh. Now somewhere that changed. Is that only a recent change, or?
I think you go back to the 60s, the years of the decade of the uprisings, that so far as I've been able to observe it, mm-hmm. that's when it began to show.
Was there ever any sort of a student faculty committee in the Department of Education in the 50s where students would help advise on potential faculty or things of that sort? Were they ever consulted?
No, I would say not. I think we had some committees, but I think it was more in the planning of student activities type of thing,
mm-hmm.
honors convocations and so forth. But I don't think on faculty selection that students were ever involved.
Mm-hmm. Even, yeah.
Well, up until I think in the 60s it began to open up a little, yes.
What about in terms of, well, of course, that tells one thing about the relationship of faculty and students,
mm-hmm.
but do you feel that there have been any changes in terms of the relationships between student and faculty? I mean, there are always little signs of address and things like that,
mm-hmm.
but one speaks to one another. But in terms of general, could you make any generalization about relationships?
Yes, and I would have to point to it as improvement. I think that when I refer back to the 30s, that it was a master-slave pattern of relationship, and if the student violated the wish of the master, it could have dire consequences, and there was the authority and the power to accomplish it and get by with it on the part of faculty members. I think that gradually gave way, and during, as I say, the decade of uprisings, late 50s and 60s, probably opened the way, not in the raucous way that it came about in the late 60s, but it did open up the thought, and properly so, that students had to have some way of finding an opportunity to register their thoughts with regarding program, courses, treatment, and so forth. And I think that's been a good thing. I think it's we've had some student rights type of resolutions and even legislations in various states. And I think, maybe some instances gone too far, but I'd have to say that it had gone too far the other way, as I recall it. Yeah. I think the students now feel that they do have an avenue of challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't for vicious purposes at all, just for protective and for the purpose of being able to proceed with their education.
Now, you mentioned that in the 30s, a certain kind of relationship. Were students very sensitive to that relationship? I mean, was that a fairly conscious thing with them, or is this a more retrospective view? That is, were students in the 30s very, very sensitive to the fact that they were quite at the mercy of their major professors?
Oh, I think so. I think so. You almost never heard of a confrontation initiated by a student
mm-hmm.
on a professor, challenging either what they said or the kind of treatment that they got.
Did you see this sort of attitude translated into the classroom, that is, in terms of how seminars would be conducted?
Yes, you listened and tried to respond as you thought the professor wanted the response.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a terrible stifling of creativity on the part of the students. It was too much that way.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Now, some people have indicated that the GI students who came after mm-hmm. World War II were of a different sort.
Mm-hmm.
Did those students tend to cause faculty to adjust their ways of treating people a little bit?
I don't know whether you can attribute that to a cause or not. I'd have to say this, as I have said many times, that the most delightful teaching that I did at either the undergraduate or graduate level was in that period when the influx of veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And I always attributed that to the fact that these people came in with more purpose than we had people coming before.
Mm-hmm.
And that purpose in itself made teaching a more challenging and certainly a more positive experience. Now, if these students did that, it was done so subtly, but not with open challenge. I can't recall a bit of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we did have more mature students who, if they wanted to challenge, could ask a question for clarifying their own thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a very neat way of challenging mm-hmm. a professor, and maybe the whole thing changed the professors a little bit too. I'm willing to attribute it to that.
Okay. another thing along the line of having to do with students is the matter of evaluating students. Of course, grades have been with us quite a bit over time, but you know, there's much talk of erosion and so on and so forth with grading and that kind of thing. Was the attitude of faculty that you knew in the 30s towards grading, for instance, quite different than it is today, or that may be an incorrect way of putting it, but if you can understand what I'm trying to get at.
Well, I'm not sure I would know how to answer that. Of course, the grade as a grade hasn't changed. An A is still called an A and that sort of thing. How they arrived at it may have changed, but on the other hand, my experience, I believe, would lead me to say that I think there's been great variability always. Mm-hmm. One person has one concept of what the expectations are, and that translates into a grade. Another one has another perception of what the expectations are, and that translates into a different kind of a grade. The thing that I think I'd have to recall is that it seemed to me that the papers that came back when I was in late 20s in the master's program had a lot more comments by the professor than I seem to be seeing in later years. And but that may be also a characteristic of the numbers that came in. How many papers did they have to grade? Mm-hmm. But it's for sure that those professors then did not have assistants grading paper. They did it themselves. Now, whatever that means, that whenever you had a question, you didn't have to go to a graduate assistant, you could go to the professor and get an answer. Mm-hmm. And maybe it was simply because of that relationship that kept us much more peaceful with respect to what grade we did get.
Mm-hmm. Now, within your own field of education administration, of course you've had experience with it for many years, do you feel that the content of coursework is as rigorous now as it was before, or vice versa, depending on how one wants to emphasize that particular outlook?
I would say yes, I believe it is, although I think there's one thing that we have to recognize, that as the years went on and the students gained more courage to ask questions, to challenge and so forth, that there was much more inclination to look for and possibly see alternative solutions or answers, whereas originally it was this way and only this way. And I think the change has been wholesome. Mm.
This is sort of a transitory question. It relates both to students and faculty, but I guess ask about students first. Some people that I've spoken with, not faculty, but some students I've spoken with, have said that they don't know, they have a certain sense of that this Department of Education Administration, I think, and perhaps the school as a whole, is different in sensitivity to questions of race than other schools they've been to. In terms of, you know, maybe just a function of the fact that Madison being the kind of town it is, and so on and so forth. Is this something that you ever sensed among the faculty, or among projects, or things of that sort, among the way students have been attracted to the school?
Yes, I think I've been aware of it ever since I was a student here, that Wisconsin always had the reputation of being a very open experience for students here. And I think a part of that has to be seen as greater equality in the treatment of whites, blacks, reds, or whatever you want to use. I think I've seen, happily so, not a great deal of prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
And I happen to like it that way, and maybe because of that I have my rose-colored glasses on, but I have not seen students, graduate students particularly, I'm talking about now, because I haven't taught undergraduate for quite a long while, I have not seen graduate students badgered in orals, and I've never seen minority students imposed upon that I could label it as that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's open, hopefully, and it will remain that way.
Now, of course, in the other side of that question, and of course, there's, well, I guess there's also the the sexist side of the question that's often raised. Of course, that one sometimes a little easier to document, but in terms of faculty, now, in the past, when Department of Education Administration, or this going further back, especially to the Department of Education, when positions were being advertised, was there any overt discrimination against faculty, or people who were applying for jobs because they were female, or that sort of thing that you sensed?
Yes. I think on many occasions I sense it, not only in the selection of new staff members, but the treatment of staff members after we got them here.
Mm-hmm.
I think that why I said a moment ago that we treat students of all types with a great deal of evenness and fairness, I think that has not happened for women in our considerations for beyond employment. I don't think they've done too well on employment, but on the other hand, in our department, there aren't that many that might be available, you see. So they got to take that into consideration. But with the women who were employed, I would say that very often, I believe I could identify some prejudicial decisions, you know, all the way back to Lois Nemec in elementary education.
Specifics?
Pardon?
Specifically concerning?
Well, she was sort of pushed out when Harry came in, out of the program, and what she wanted to teach, her new courses and that type of thing, until she finally retired. Some 15 years later, somebody over in CNI, bless their hearts, realized that everybody else, when they retired, became an emeritus professor, and so they did that 15 years after the fact, which means that at the time she retired, nobody was paying much attention.
Mm-hmm.
We've had others come and go, and very often with the thought that they had not been treated equitably in salary. I'd have to say that I have observed it in our own department. An example would be that the person that held the associate or full professorship, and it was salary consideration, and $2,000 was offered for, by I think, out of the chancellor's office, which would not have hurt the number of dollars that anybody else in the department would have gotten.
Mm-hmm.
And when this came before the department, three members just grabbed their pencils and started figuring, and they said they didn't think it was necessary for this woman member of the staff because she was already at the median and that was good enough. Well, when they looked into it, she was $400 above the top of the bottom half and about $4,000 below the bottom of the top half. And yet it was median, you see, mm-hmm. statistically. Mm-hmm. That to me, and then that went into an investigation by Dave Johnson from the Chancellor's office, who was then Edwin Young, and his conclusion finally was that there was no prejudice exhibited because the decision was made in an open meeting and a vote of all eligible faculty members. My response to that was and is now, that's the way the mafia decide to eliminate one member of their own family that they think has gotten in the way or gone astray. And the demise is voted democratically, therefore there's no prejudice existed. I'm afraid we have a long ways to go as a total institution, maybe as a society.
I'll leave that. again, sticking with faculty, of course, we've already noted some of the changes that have occurred, like in terms of research and that sort of thing, the emphasis. For, well, start with the first question. Overall, or faculty that you've been involved with in helping choose and whatnot, has there been a change in the emphasis of the kind of person you've been looking for over time, particularly involved with education administration?
Well, no, I don't believe so. It seems to me, as far back as I can remember, if it was a staff member in administration, we wanted to know what kind of background they had in administration.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe we let up a little on the field experience requirement and would accept less of that and more of the research type of publication.
Mm-hmm.
As I'm talking now about sort of weighting of the criteria, I think there's been a little change in that direction, but otherwise not really not very much.
Okay. What about the selection procedures themselves? Now, for instance, Russ Hassler related how he was interviewed, the whole process of his selection, mm-hmm. which, you know, is rather casual. At what point was the process of selection rather more formalized than it is? As you know, with the system of inviting and sending out and being very up and up. And
I would suspect it would date back pretty well to the Faulks administration, where they said, get a system of screening. And I think most of the departments then went to individual committees and gave those committees a responsibility for summarizing the information that would be available and managing the invitations in for interviews and eventually to make a recommendation to the department.
Now, for instance, during the 50s, if the Department of Education needed a new faculty person,
mm-hmm.
did they tend to advertise nationally, or do they sort of just sit down among the members and say, well, I think I know a person A who would fit mm-hmm. this spot very well?
No, as I recall, when you say nationally, I would say by selected institutions,
mm-hmm.
maybe 10 or 15. Where members of our faculty knew the dean or knew department chairman or knew individuals on that campus, and then write and say, do you have somebody to recommend? That isn't quite a national, like if you put in the Chronicle of Higher
right.
Education. I can't recall we were doing that. No.
Okay. Well, of course, you already mentioned the problem with women of the treatment once they've been hired.
Mm-hmm.
Once anyone has been hired, have there been changes in terms of what is necessary to achieve promotion, to achieve tenure,
mm-hmm.
Merit, salary increases? Has there been any shift that way, or is it still pretty much the balance of research and so on?
I would say I don't think it's changed an awful lot. I think the emphasis is still pretty much on research and publications, and in recent years the corollary of that has been how much research money do you bring in.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm afraid teaching still has not weighed very heavily in making these determinations.
Your department, of course, is in a peculiar position because of the fact that it is now solely a graduate department.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the past, you used to teach undergraduates.
Yes, that's right.
Once you became strictly a graduate department, and then you would have your annual evaluations, have you perceived a change and a shift away from emphasis on teaching as a consideration from that respect?
I don't believe anyone would admit that, but I'd have to say yes. I think the final action would indicate that teaching has not achieved or maintained equality with other criteria such as research and writing or publication.
That is I'm suggesting primarily as a structural thing, that because you no longer have much contact with undergraduates, where the load of teaching is.
That might be true. On the other hand, I'm afraid that the university value system
mm-hmm.
Permeates the, and places a higher value on publication. And that's publication of research primarily. In other words, the payoff has been attached to that so often that it's become a part of our value system, I think.
Okay. First of all, we're going to backtrack and pick up a couple of odds and ends. Your involvement with the State Education Post-War Planning Commission that
yes.
put together in 1943.
That did kind of grow out of considerations of many of the professional organizations here in Wisconsin. The Joint Committee was composed of elementary principals, association representatives, secondary principals, Superintendents Association, Wisconsin Teachers Colleges, Directors of Vocational Adult Education. In other words, we had about every segment of organized education here in Wisconsin represented on that committee, including the representatives of the Department of Public Instruction. And I think that there were several prime issues that may have brought this on. One of them was vocational education impact. When I first came here and prior to this report, we really had divided programs in the high schools.
Mm-hmm.
And the DPI had direct control over the academics programs, for instance. But then there was some vocational subjects where there were federal subsidies. Agriculture, homemaking. And that direct administration came from the Office of the Director of the Vocational Technical Education. And many, for instance, I can recall that the supervisor in vocational education determined the length of the period for agriculture classes. And the principals couldn't violate that, even though they wanted to put the rest of the schedule on, say, a 50-minute period rather than a 60-minute period, so that there was much distress over the duplicate state management in education at the secondary level. And one of the things that occupied much of the discussion in that committee was this very thing. And there was a firm position taken that there was no desire to combine the total vocational education program in this state with the DPI, but rather to move in the direction of taking that portion, which was a part of a high school program, and making that under the Department of Public Instruction so that you wouldn't have divided management and controls over programs within a single school building out in the field. I think that eventually that did come about, and I think maybe the committee may have pushed that along a little. And the other thing that I guess maybe the committee didn't can't claim too much direct responsibility for the changes, but I think increased emphasis on health, which grew out of our interest in the war, an increased concern with the kinds of math and science courses that could help support a war machine, and eventually even the Navy began to hold a few meetings, and the state superintendents and associations such as we had here joined in, and what can we do to soup up, sharpen up the programs in mathematics, for instance, so that when recruits go in, that they don't have to be taught arithmetic. Milt Powell and I happened to have written during the Korean episode four or five or six books for illiterate Negro soldiers in the South to sharpen them up in basic mathematics for being able to handle the increasingly complicated equipment that was characteristic of war machine.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that the Post-War Planning Committee provided a focal point for people to begin to look at what do we need now when we get through fighting this war and its after effects to sharpen up our educational program. And I think for a little while that its influence was felt. But to say it was lasting, nothing is that lasting. You have to perpetuate it. And this committee made its report and disbanded.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was up to Department of Public Instruction from then on.
One other thing that we touched on briefly earlier and mentioned with Dean McCarty was the NCATE report that you helped prepare. Now, this report was done, let's see, 69?
I guess something about like that.
I'm not sure I have a date here.
It was 10 years after the ones when Stiles was here, and we had our complications of getting accredited because the committee thought we ought not to have so many LNS faculty members accepted as full voting members of the School of Education. Wisconsin had no desire to change that, and we defended it, and it made quite a national splash. Now, that doesn't say that we didn't come back all right under the one with McCarty, and that we were able to gain accreditation without any reservations, whatever. Now, I don't believe any of us ever got the feeling that there should not be accreditation, even during the first little conflict there. After all, high school accreditation has been going on for a long, long time, originally by Departments of Public Instruction.
Mm-hmm.
And it was either that or the colleges would give admissions examinations, decide whether they admit people from high school. So it isn't any different. And the NCATE then developed standards and went through the accreditation process to say that the graduates of this institution are worthy of accreditation. Now, it's true that our graduates could be certificated
mm-hmm.
in Wisconsin, but you go across the state line, then accreditation becomes important for those students, and we have a lot of students who get their education here and then want to teach in some other state. Now, they would have been handicapped badly had we not been accredited. And the logic of it is supportable, I think, in that the NCATE developed, I think, a very good set of standards for schools to meet.
Mm-hmm.
It is important that you have a certain number of books in the library if you're going to support an instructional program. It is important that you have qualified professors in the area in which they're teaching. It is important that you control the credit distribution and that sort of thing. That's what the NCATE standards provide, a structure for building toward what looks like guaranteed to a quality program.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a great deal of confidence in that.
Now, the NCATE report that you put together, did it concern itself considerably with defending the position that had been held in 59?
No.
Did you tend to shy away from that, or
we
was it not a matter of concern anymore?
It was not a matter of concern because that had nothing whatever to do with collecting the kind of data that would prove that we've met the standards.
Mm-hmm.
And we've made 100% effort to do that and to document every bit of the data submitted.
Is that, are those kinds of reports then, you know, as I say, the kinds of monstrous things that, that end up on the shelves after they've been put through, are those kinds of things something that one does, or the school does, sort of continuously keeps the same perspective from time to time, or is each time through a matter of, has it been a matter of specific problems that are brought up at this specific time?
When we drafted the report for NCATE, we did on the last few pages indicate that this School of Education was committing itself to a continuous accumulation and review of supportive information. I'm afraid that has not been done. That's entirely up to a dean as to whether it shall be. And then the rest of the response has to be, yes, probably it's on a shelf somewhere collecting dust. I happen to have a copy of it because I was doing writing in that, but that's a personal thing, and it's entirely up to a dean and his staff as to whether they would put the money in, and personnel. It takes quite a little if you're going to maintain an evolving type of data support or data bank, which would support continuing evidence that the standards are being met. Now, I haven't checked. It may be that this has been done by our current dean. I don't know, and it really wouldn't be my business to even ask him.
You have some concluding remarks here for...
Well, I suppose, yes, I have, since I entered the graduate school in 1926 and earned my degrees here, and then spent 34 years on the as a faculty member in the School of Education departments, that those many years of experience, both as a student and as a faculty member, supports what I say is great pride that I have in this university and in this School of Education. I find it still thrilling to even think about the fact that I've had this privilege of association with the University of Wisconsin. And then when recently it was indicated that other schools had voted us among the top 10 schools of education in the country, why, it gives me even further reason to support my pride in being here and having this opportunity to be associated with it.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You're quite welcome.